The court is now calling A24157. Excuse me. Sorry about that. A250060 Presbyterian Family Foundation on behalf of Solveig Berg, respondent versus Robert Norby, appellant. Good morning, counsel, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Paul Harris. Along with me are Judge Diane Bradfield and Judge Louise Bjorkman. In a moment, we are going to begin your oral argument. However, I have a couple of announcements before we begin. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, with appellant having a 5-minute rebuttal. This matter is being recorded and will be placed on our website. So I ask that for each part of your argument, you please state your name for the record. With that, the appellant can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, my name is Dan Plambeck. I am the attorney for Robert Norby in this matter. This matter, as the court knows, involves a harassment restraining order that was issued by the district court. In the appellant's position is that there is no sufficient evidence to support this harassment restraining order that was issued. As the court knows, pursuant to 609.748 Minnesota statutes, a harassment restraining or a harassment is defined as repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts. And since there's no claim in here that there were some words or gestures involved, I'm focusing on intrusive or unwanted acts that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another. First of all, I don't believe there are repeated incidents of any such conduct, let alone a single incident of such conduct. In all respects in this case, there were no intrusive or unwanted acts committed by Mr. Norby related to Solveig Berg. Everything that he was doing for her was with her knowledge and with her consent, and it was clearly something that she wanted from him.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Plambeck, before we get into the record? Just assume under different facts, I guess, is my question is maybe more addressed to the law. Would you agree that repeated instances of interfering with somebody's medical care or interfering with their financial matters, if it has a substantial adverse impact on the other person, could under the law constitute harassment? Again, not saying that those facts are present here, but just trying to get a sense of whether this kind of harassment can be found under the law.
And we'll just break that down. Yes, I would agree that if there was some kind of repeated incident involving interference with somebody's medical care, that could constitute a intrusive or unwanted act. And I'd also agree that if there was some repeated incidents involving another individual's finances that was intrusive or unwanted, that could be harassment. That's one side of the statute. The other part of it is, though, that there has to be a substantial adverse effect or intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of that other individual. So what has to be proved is that there's this objectively unreasonable conduct, whether it involves medical care or involves finances. There has to have some objectively unreasonable conduct or intent. In this case, there's neither. In this case, everything that Mr. Norby was doing regarding Solveig Berg and her medical care and her finances was done with her knowledge and consent, and it wasn't unreasonable. It's not unreasonable for an individual like Mr. Norby, who had a past history with Solveig Berg, to get involved in her life, in any aspect of her life. After her husband had died in August of 2023, she reached out to Mr. Norby because they had been neighbors and grew up in the same general area north of Moorhead, Minnesota, in the Cragness area, in a rural area. living on farms in that area of Clay County. And so they got to know each other. And as Solveig Berg testified, she had known Robert Norby all his life. And that's why she reached out to him after her husband died. And so Mr. Norby responded to her and went to see her at River Point. There was nobody else that she reached out to at that point in time because she had no other family. She reached out to Mr. Norby because she knew him and she trusted him. Mr. Norby did get involved in her medical care. She was having severe back pain and knee pain, and he helped her to find some other care other than what she was receiving because he wanted to help her. So that involved going to see a chiropractor. That involved going to Essentia Health and trying a new doctor. And those things he did do. And in that process, there were some changes to her medication, but those were changes made by her doctor, not by Mr. Norby. Mr. Norby never professed to be a doctor or have any knowledge about medicine or what should be done. Instead, he, as Solveig Berg even testified, what Bob Norby told her to do is to follow the direction of the doctors. So he wasn't making any of these de decisions for her, but he certainly was assisting her with her medical care. And I think that's what somebody like Solveig.
I can understand, where why what Mr. Norby's basis was for contesting the HRO and your arguments today. What I guess what I'm struggling with is the district court did have other evidence, had evidence of a significant decline in Ms. Berg's health following her, and remembering too, Ms. Berg is suffering from dementia and some other ongoing health issues that, I mean, she has an emergency guardianship, at least did at the time of the hearing. So I guess keep putting all of these factors, because that's what the district court
Right,
had to
right.
consider, all of this evidence, not just
Sure.
the parts that you're mentioning, but
Right.
had also considered the fact that she had a precipitous decline in her health after making some of these changes. It seems to me it was within the district court's ability to take a different inference than the one you're arguing for, and to actually find that no, this is unreasonable conduct that did harm Ms. Berg as to her medical health. So it help me out. I think that's what the district court was thinking. So if
Yes.
you'd address that. Thank
Yes, and I don't agree with just assuming that because she may have a decline in her health and that had been preceded by some changes in seeing other doctors, that Mr. Norby is responsible for that. I think it would have been it could only be supported if you had some kind of evidence showing a causal link between something Mr. Norby did that was unreasonable as compared to what the doctors did or recommended during the course of her care. And I don't think there's a sufficient evidence to support a finding of a causal connection between anything that Mr. Norby did and anything that may have happened to Solveig Berg after he got involved in her life again.
So,
I think that would.
counsel, can you then address, because it's my understanding that there's testimony that Mr. Norby discontinued River Point's bathing, meals, and housekeeping services, and that caused the individual to become unkempt, run down, unclean, to the point of developing sores on their legs, and I believe ending up not being able to walk. And it's my understanding in reviewing the transcript that that was supported by testimony from individuals at the care facility. Why wouldn't that be sufficient given that the court had that testimony and credited the testimony and gave credibility determinations to the individuals making the testimony? Why isn't that sufficient at least for one of the acts? And then my follow-up question would be, then there was the discovery of the bills not being paid, again supported by testimony from individuals who worked at River Point. Why wouldn't that be sufficient to again have a second finding, which again now we have repeated acts, words, or gestures that had an adverse effect on her health. Explain to me why that would not be sufficient.
Well, how are you attributing those particular acts or what you're characterizing as conduct to Mr. Norby?
Well, counsel,
I yeah.
again, my question then is that the district court indicated and found, based on the testimony, that Mr. Norby discontinued this, particularly the bathing, meals, and housekeeping. That's what was testified to. And it seems to me that the district court credited that testimony. And in our role, we are not to kind of reweigh the credibility. So if the court credited those individuals as being credible, noted that the testimony was that they indicated that he discontinued the services, why isn't that sufficient?
I think, Judge, that if there was a discontinuance of those services, it was a matter of the fact that Mr. Norby was now in her life and providing those services. Okay? It's not a situation where those particular services had any kind of substantial adverse effect on Solveig Berg. At least there's no indication that there is. Maybe other people would have other expectations. I don't know. But that is not something that I believe is the fact that he may be participating in those particular self-cares for Solveig Berg, given their relationship, was inappropriate or unreasonable, and not to pay for
Isn't the
those
issue,
services because this is an assisted living facility in which.
isn't the issue before this court, though, whether there is evidence in the record to support the various findings of fact the district court made? I mean, I think you've made a good case for why the court could have made different findings, but that's not really our issue. The question before an appellate court is, are these findings of fact clearly erroneous? And so, with respect to this issue about your client discontinuing some of River Point's services and that Ms. Berg declined after that, I mean, was there testimony or other evidence in the record that supports that particular finding of fact?
There's actually some evidence in the record that disputes, and I understand what you're saying about clearly erroneous standard, but what I do want to point out is that there was another witness, Johanna Wicks, who testified at the hearing. This is an individual who is identified as the emergency contact person for Solveig Berg and a longtime friend and very close to her, who is always looking out for Solveig Berg's best interests. And she took issue with some of those things that you're referring to about, for example, the oozing on the legs and how Johanna Wicks characterized that, because she didn't think that was a fair characterization. And that's not on Mr. Norby. I don't see anything about what happened there as being so unreasonable that Mr. Norby be involved in her self-cares that it would rise to any kind of possible unreasonable conduct. And that's not why Solveig Berg, went into the hospital. We actually don't know all of that information because we don't have those medical records. We don't have the medical records to figure out exactly what changes were made to her medical care. And that's one thing that I asked for. All those medical records be made available from
Well,
that.
counsel, you asked for them on the third day of the evidentiary hearing. And I mean, I'm looking back at the original, well, I think I'm looking at in your addendum, the corrected petition, but the petition seeking the HRO did specifically reference harmful and inappropriate, continuing to deny medical treatment. So it seems to me your client was on notice from the beginning of this proceeding that medical care was at issue, and it wouldn't Wasn't the time to ask for medical records before the third day of the evidentiary hearing?
Well, Your Honor, this started on, I believe it was June 6th, and we're supposed to make our request for a hearing within 20 days. We made our request for a hearing. It got scheduled for July 18, and that happened to be a bad day for me, and I had to ask for a continuance of that particular first hearing date. In any event, we were in anticipating that we would be able to get medical records to know exactly what was going on. We'd been in touch with the chiropractor, but he wouldn't talk to us. because of the confidentiality requirements, because of HIPAA. We couldn't get those medical records. And as things developed, we first had our hearing in August, and then all of this, the evidence starts coming out, and what was going to be necessary would be some medical records to refute these claims that somehow Mr. Norby was responsible for all of these things when it wasn't Mr. Norby, in our view, and that was his testimony, and that's Solveig Berg's testimony. These aren't decisions that they were making on their own. They were discussing with their doctors. And I think it was perfectly reasonable for me to make a request at any time in the course of those hearings that those records be made available for the court to consider, particularly given the gravity of this particular claim, this harassment restraining order to separate these two people who are essentially, or that Solveig Berg is essentially alone in her life and wanted that companionship and deserved it. And I don't
Counsel,
understand.
I do see that your time is up, so I will give you a moment to finish that thought, but it needs to be fairly brief here.
Let's see where, okay. I don't think that no matter how you look at the record, that Mr. Norby's conduct was unreasonable in any respect, or that his intent was something that was unreasonable. He always wanted to support the Solveig Berg's best interests, and that was his goal, and that's what he was trying to do.
All right, thank you, counsel. All right, the respondent, we're just going to reset the clock. And once that is reset, all right, counsel, you can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Appellant's claims in this case that the district court abused its discretion are without merit. Appellant has not demonstrated in his brief or in argument that the district court abused its discretion in granting the HRO. What has been largely claimed and has been discussed and brought up by many of the questions by your honors is he's making alternative arguments that were not accepted by the district court. The district court heard many of these arguments at the trial. They were raised. We had a 3-day evidentiary hearing on an HRO, which is pretty dang long for one of those. And lots of arguments were made and testimony was received. And those arguments were not part of the order. So that's not what this court is to review. This court is required to look at the findings of the district court judge and decide whether those are reasonably supported by the record. And taking that in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, the petitioner. And if those are reasonably supported by the record, whether there are alternatives is irrelevant. They only become relevant if those findings are not supported. And then perhaps those arguments come into play.
Counsel,
in this case,
many of the district court's findings focus on the interference, the claimed interference with medical care. How do you respond to the appellant's argument that the appellant himself isn't responsible for what happened as a result of the treatment changes, because those were changes recommended by medical providers that Mr. Berg just, or Mr. Norby just followed? How do you respond to that argument?
At trial, this was brought up that there were other doctors that were seeing Ms. Berg. The only specific doctor that was brought up, I believe, was a chiropractor. And the actual details on what was happening with those doctors was pretty vague. But on the other side, we had the nurse who sees her every day. We had the executive director of the nursing home facility and her guardianship attorney. These are all people that know her well, reporting that she's declining significantly. So the claim that these other doctors were doing something else that was helpful. I don't see it based on the record. It was pretty vague. Additionally, you know, we didn't have any real evidence that they had been doing those things that were said. None at all. So I don't think the district court could rely on that because there wasn't enough evidence for that. And there was a lot of evidence showing that when Norby showed up, Berg would refuse her medications, or Ashley May testified, the nurse, that he would direct her to refuse her medications, or he would refuse them for her. And so that's what was being reported. And we're talking day after day through a period of months, he would visit, these things would happen, and she declined and ended up hospitalized. You know, all that's really required to prove that the harassment occurred is that his acts had a substantial adverse effect. So I know a lot's been talked about his intent. Intent can be relevant to an HRO determination, but it's not relevant if there is a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of the person who is being victimized. And I think when you consider, so we had testimony from Ashley May, Carmen Escobar, Hannah Scheidecker on these points. We also had testimony about some possible financial exploitation or attempts at that. And I think considering these things together, what we're looking at here is possible elder abuse or being taken advantage of. This relationship started after, and the testimony supports this, this relationship started after Miss Berg's husband passed away. Norby showed up. Nobody knew who he was. He said he might have been, he said he was her cousin. He said he was a friend. It was pretty unclear. And then they got married semi-secretly. And then he's intruding in her medical care and taking her to the bank with another adult male to see if he can withdraw or transfer $415,000.
And I understand, counsel, that Mr. Norby did not provide an explanation for that attempt to transfer, the purpose of it, but it didn't happen either, right? Am I right about that? And I
That's
guess
correct.
You referred to financial exploitation. I mean, I don't see that finding in the district court's order. Maybe I missed it.
No. I think you're right, Your Honor. It is not an explicit finding in the district court.
Well, not even implicit, is it? I mean, there is this mention. You're right. I mean, there's a whole paragraph H about the this visit to the talk about transferring funds to a Bell Bank account, but it didn't actually happen. Now, I just putting it in the context of an HRO needing to show all of the steps. I mean, do you think H is sufficient to support an act at least of that sufficient for an issue? So just tell me how. Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And it's kind of the flip of the medical stuff where we don't have the effect necessarily because the act wasn't completed that I, you know, suspected was going on. But if you look at that act in combination with the medical issues that Berg was having as the result of Norby and the timing of the relationship, I think there's a strong inference there that he had the intent to affect her financial security in a substantial way. Certainly, managing a $415,000 wrongly or taking it outright would be a substantial adverse effect on her financial security. I don't know all the specifics of her finances, but that's a substantial amount of money. So I think that's how it supports a harassment finding, because if you consider all the circumstances in the light most favorable to the petitioner, that inference is there. I don't, in my review of appellant's claims on the sufficiency of the evidence issue. I didn't see that many of the facts. Well, I saw that facts were disputed, but there was not much argument as to why the facts were clearly erroneous. And I think because there isn't an argument for that. There was a lot of testimony consistent. Again, Ashley May, Hannah Scheidecker, and Carmen Escobar watched the decline. They saw what happened. They didn't do anything right away. They weren't sure about it. But then she was hospitalized. And they all consistently testified that when Norby was visiting and talking to her and interfering or intruding in her life, that she was declining. And when he left, she got better. Again, it's circumstantial. We didn't have anyone say, oh yeah, it's clearly Norby who did it. But the evidence shows that when he came into the picture, things got bad, and they got better when he left. My conclusion here is that there's plenty of evidence to support that he intruded or was intrusive into Berg's medical care. He got in there, he got in the way of her medications, he changed her medications, he changed the pharmacy. And we're talking about blood pressure pills where she doesn't take them. She may have a stroke or a heart attack, and she ended up hospitalized. I believe they said her BP got to 200 over 100, which is quite high. There's plenty of evidence showing he intruded into her care at the facility, canceling appointments. Preventing staff from assisting with hygiene, which led her to looking run down and tired and just not well taken care of. And that cuts against Norby's claim that he was trying to help her out and do the right thing. And even if he was, if his acts caused a substantial adverse effect on her safety, security, and privacy, and they were intrusive, it's still harassment. The medical evidence was clearly the strongest. I think the financial issue was cut off pretty quickly by three people who essentially wouldn't give him the information. He asked her guardianship attorney extensively about her finances, trying to get access. That person could not give him that information for obvious reasons. And he also spoke with Carmen Escobar, the executive director, who again is not going to give him that information. And then you had a bank manager who probably sees this type of thing. We didn't have his testimony, so we don't know that. But the bank manager that saw this thought, this doesn't look right. I'm not allowing him to do this transaction. And I think there was even a statement in there in that police report, which in which Berg said, what account are we talking about? Or something of that nature. So she was clearly not in the right frame of mind to be making such a large transfer or any transfer at all. So the district court's order granting the HRO should be affirmed. The district court applied the law correctly, found that intrusive acts, medical care affected substantially Miss Berg, her safety. And those facts are supported by the testimony of multiple witnesses and exhibits, much of which was not impeached or discredited. I don't remember much discrediting. I looked at the transcript again. It wasn't there. It was mostly the defense was, I have this other intent, and it's not negative, and this is not harassment. Well, that argument was rejected by the district court, so that's not a consideration here. As to appellant's second claim that the motion to compel was denying that motion was a abuse of discretion. Frankly, I think it may have been an abuse of discretion to grant the motion. This was a complete surprise. We didn't present extensive medical records because it was unnecessary, and it's an HRO and things move quickly.
I'm surprised by your statement that you wouldn't have expected medical records to be of import, given the nature of the claimed harassment. That, yes, there were financial aspects of it, but it did focus very extensively on the medical care that Ms. Berg received or did not receive and that impact on her. Help me understand why you would have been surprised by a records request.
I completely agree with you, Your Honor. It was central and highly relevant. What I meant was I was just surprised by the timing of it at the end of the trial. I didn't expect the request at that time. Usually, you reach out before. And in the HROs, it is hard to get things done in time. They move quickly. But if you ask before trial, usually you're going to get some leeway there to try to get the stuff you need for your case. And so there wasn't a statute cited or a discovery rule cited. And so the judge used their discretion and said it's too late or it's extremely late. And I couldn't find a rule that necessarily contradicts that statement. And by any stretch, a request made during trial is extremely late, and certainly by the end of trial, during the last testimony of the last witness. So there's no abuse of discretion there. That was a proper ruling that made sense considering we had been at trial for 3 days and it was almost over. And thank you for your time today. That's all I have.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Plumbeck, we're just going to reset the timer for your 5-minute rebuttal. All right, I see that that timer has been reset. You can begin your rebuttal when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to ask each of you judges to read the testimony of Sandra Fleming, Johanna Wicks, and Solveig Berg, pages 120 to 154. I think that is the most compelling evidence that was presented in this case. It's the testimony of Solveig Berg, who's, I thought, did a great job testifying for somebody who everybody thinks has a bad case of dementia. As we all know, dementia is a matter of degrees, and where she may be at any particular time may vary. But she did an excellent job, and she was responsive, and she gave nobody any reason to be concerned about her relationship with Mr. Norby. She has just glowing things to say about him. And the same is true of Sandra Fleming, who is Solveig Berg's oldest friend. They've known each other for 48 years. And she also spoke highly of Mr. Norby. Same thing with Johanna Wicks, who hadn't known Mr. Norby personally prior, although she had heard of him. She got to know him after Solveig's husband Ken died. And she's also very supportive of their relationship. And doesn't understand why these two people can't be together. And she's very sad about that. I'm disappointed that in Hannah Scheidecker's case, who had been Solveig Berg's court-appointed attorney in the original guardianship, but when that guardianship ended, she was no longer an attorney. They're not appointed for life. And at the time that there was an application for a restraining order, she was not her attorney. And in any event, she didn't even take the time to sit down with Solveig Berg to discuss with her Robert Norby and what was going on and if she had any concerns. And why is that? Why is she being treated as if her feelings don't count in this case? I don't think she was even present for the hearing on the first 2 days of our hearing, which all was conducted by Zoom. And I think in hindsight, this all should have been done in the courtroom in person. This was just the wrong way to handle it. How she feels in this case is a substantial part of what must be proved in order to grant a harassment restraining order. And she doesn't feel that she was being harassed. She doesn't feel that she was being taken advantage of or threatened in any way. It's just, it was also puzzling to me that at the end of the hearing on the last day, and when the court wanted to have oral arguments right away, closing arguments right away, and made a ruling from the bench right away, that the judge turned to Mr. Hertogs and asked him how long he wants the restraining order to last, and he asked for 2 years. The original petition that was filed asked for 1 year. The amended petition that was filed asked for 1 year. It has been 1 year basically since that petition was filed and the original temporary HRO was issued. Now we got another year to go on something that never should have been granted in the first place. I don't see it. I just don't understand how there could be a harassment restraining order in these circumstances based on this record. Thank you.
Thank you both for your argument today and for your briefing in this matter. This matter has been submitted. We will issue an order, an opinion within the statutory guidelines. With that, that does conclude our oral argument calendar for today. We will now conclude the hearing at this time to discuss these cases. Thank you, counsel, again, and you are free to log off.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honors.